Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 22nd day of January, 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. As you know, I was in the hospital with COVID for 15 days 1 year ago right now. And I talked about that at length in a show that I did here on TalkRadio1.com on January 30, 2021. If you haven't heard that, I'd suggest listening to it. It really is a story of what it's like inside the hospital as a COVID patient for 15 days. It's you wouldn't like it. But it's a fascinating story, and I really recommend that one. Look it up, talkradio1.com, January 30, 2021 show, The Stephen Spear Show. So, COVID is what I want to talk about today, and I found the right person with whom to have that discussion. We're not going to sound like what you hear every day, what you hear from the media, what you read on the internet, or even what you might hear from the CDC, the White House, or any other source on the outside. To me, the fragmented news coverage and social media have created so much confusion. I want to see if we can clear some of it up. So I have something different in mind. It is my pleasure to say, Dr. Buzz Hollander, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Dr. Hollander lives on the Big Island of Hawaii, and he has 17 years of experience in both clinical and emergency room settings. He is a specialist in family medicine and graduated from Princeton University, attended UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine, and completed his residency at California's Santa Rosa Family Medicine Residency Program. Buzz Hollander has written extensively on all things COVID, and I asked him to join me today because he makes sense. It's that simple. Dr. Hollander, you wrote an article that was published in Real Clear Science, and that article was dated August 23, 2021. I'm going to read just a few excerpts and then ask you a question on the other side. You said, "Never have I been asked about one subject so much as the COVID-19 vaccines, and never have I seen so much doubt and confusion among a group of smart, well-educated people. Speaking the truth about vaccines, however, should not be that hard. We have to be willing to adapt to new data, even when it does not fit neatly into prior messaging. That's where our institutions went astray. Patients and doctors, looking to the CDC for guidance in decision-making, received low-quality or dated information. The mainstream media is stuck between reporting public health dictates as valid while being unable to resist doom and gloom reports of vaccine failures that sell ad space. The obvious gap between what the CDC says and what we see, hear, and read has left large space for grifters, self-styled experts, and conspiracy theorists to thrive, especially among the large group of vaccine-hesitant, often vaccine-terrified Americans. The whole thing might have gone better if we had stuck to telling the truth as we know it." So my question has to be, what is the truth today, Dr. Hollander, as of now? From a medical point of view, who should be careful, who should be carefree, and who should be in between?
That's a great question to kick off with, Steve. And I would say that it really comes down to where you fall on the spectrum of risk status and risk tolerance. I think it's possible to be a 60-year-old diabetic who is double vaccinated and boosted and feel very confident going back about their regular life again and figuring that their risk of a hospitalization from a viral infection might be similar to a bad flu season of years past. And it's also possible to be a 19-year-old college student who is double vaccinated and boosted and healthy and terrified of a remote risk of long COVID or giving a COVID virus to their great-grandmother.
should that 19-year-old be terrified about giving that virus to their grandmother if grandma is double vaxxed and boosted?
I would say no. I think if you're really trying to frame things in terms of probabilities of bad things happening and putting that in the context of what we've all gotten used to in our lifetimes, in terms of infectious disease and other bad things happening in life, I don't think they need to be concerned. I don't think they needed to be boosted in the first place. But some people have gotten their risk meter has been turned up to 11 over the last 2 years.
My wife and I have 9 grandchildren, and they range in age from 1 year to 9 years of age. 2 of them currently have COVID. I should say one has been diagnosed with COVID, and I think the other one's going to get diagnosed today with COVID. And the young one, the youngest one, is not vaccinated, under 5. How worried should anybody be about them?
I think that we have got pretty good information at this point that although the under 5 age group is more vulnerable to severe COVID than that 5 to 12 group, which is the least vulnerable, the safest in the setting of this infection, that the numbers line up pretty well with flu infections, probably milder than RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. And therefore, it's always unnerving for parents when their kids have fevers and a cough and look like their breathing might be a little compromised. It is something that kills kids more than most other things in the world, respiratory viruses. But if you look at the probabilities, you can still say, if I've got a healthy kid without a known neurodevelopmental disorder or immunocompromised condition, that the chances that case of COVID are going to lead to a hospitalization are going to be way, way under 1%. And for that reason, I think it's okay to be watchful, but relaxed.
Once I was vaccinated, I completed both of the Moderna vaccines and then was 2 weeks past the second vaccine. And that happened for me in about April of 2020. I really felt good to go. Since then, I felt that I'm done. I'll wear a mask as a courtesy to someone else. I'll wear a mask if someone wants me to. But for me, to protect me, I don't need to wear a mask. I've been to Disneyland a few times and Disney World in October with the family. I eat inside restaurants. I am completely carefree about it. I feel even more that way because I had that severe case of COVID in January of 2021. But since I'm vaccinated, I feel like COVID is over for me personally. Am I over the top on that?
I don't think so. And I do think it's important to look at these sorts of things through two different lenses. And the first lens, which is what you're asking me, is on a personal level, should I be unduly concerned with my risk of getting COVID and what could happen to me? And I think the best way to assess that, it's an imperfect tool, but there are various COVID risk calculators out there. I like the one that The Economist has up on their website. And you can literally put in your comorbidities and your age and your gender and see what your risk of, as an unvaccinated non-immune person, what your risk of hospitalization and death would be from a case of COVID. And you might see a number depending on, you know, for instance, a healthy person in their 50s is usually going to be around 5% or so. Known case of COVID, risk of hospitalization. And then you can say that, wow, if you have a case of probably alpha strain COVID in your blood already, and then full vaccination, and then a Moderna booster, you can feel confident that that is at least 90% lower than the number that pops up on your screen. So now you're starting to get, you know, in the 1 in 200 sort of range. And then you ask yourself, if I were to get a case of COVID, am I comfortable with a 1 in 200 risk of hospitalization? Is that worth it to me to have repeat exposures to do the things that matter to me in life? My answer to that is, yeah, I'm okay with that. My risk of dying or being hospitalized with the flu 2 years ago is not that different than numbers like that, because the flu vaccine is so much less effective to counteract the fact that it is a less virulent sort of pathogen. Now, I do feel like I need to say the other lens to look at that through is the public health perspective, where if everybody like us who's got a low risk of hospitalization, 1 in 200, 1 in 500, goes out and parties like it is 1999, that does end up putting burden on the hospitals when we're at peak surge, essentially, with something like Omicron. So there's the societal perspective. If everybody gets over this at the same time, it's going to be hard on the hospitals. And that, in turn, is bad for everybody who might happen to get in a car crash or have a heart attack tomorrow.
So from the personal point of view, you're not alarmed by what I'm saying for me, but now let's talk about that public concern. We need to protect grandma, so there's that. We need to protect the hospital system so we don't overwhelm the hospital system. Do we need to protect the unvaccinated?
That is an ethical question without an easy answer. Not speaking as a physician or someone who likes to see the hospitals functional, I would say, I don't think so. I think people make their own decision. And if they leave themselves at a higher risk, especially if they're a person at risk of severe disease because they're elderly or have a condition like diabetes, then they've made a choice. Now, the conversation is a little more difficult when you're talking about someone who's immunocompromised. I have a couple cancer patients on my patient panel who are undergoing chemotherapy or recently underwent it, that they just can't make antibodies to a COVID vaccine. And that's the group that I think feels most vulnerable and most offended when they see people taking a, I'm over this, I'm going out to the bars point of view, because their only real option is either accept the risk or shelter, which has got to be getting old after 2 years.
It does. So that becomes the question. If everyone had gone out and got vaccinated, or for that matter, if today everyone went out and got vaccinated, would that protect that group of people who can't make antibodies and whose only other choices would be to take the risk or shelter?
That was the original point of view that we had when we had that early vaccine efficacy data from the trials that was overwhelming. And of course, reality then got in the way. And especially with Omicron, Delta to a lesser degree, and with some waning of the vaccines, it's gotten pretty clear that vaccines continue to do an excellent job at protecting the vaccinated from severe disease, and not a lot of heavy lifting in terms of protecting us from mild infection that we can pass along to a vulnerable person. So I'm afraid there isn't really a way to protect the immunocompromised that can't get vaccinated other than everybody staying home, which, unfortunately, I don't need to tell you, it's not a long-term viable option for society.
So let's talk about the unvaccinated. How, if someone is unvaccinated today, how would, and assuming there's not a medical prohibition for that individual to get the vaccine, but they choose not to be vaccinated, how should that person today, now, January 22, 2022, how should they be making the decision? What are the pros and cons for them to decide whether to get vaccinated now or not?
I think it's an easy decision, with the only possible exception being if an unvaccinated person has a known confirmed prior infection. And the data is a bit murky. How protective is it if you got it back in May of 2020 versus if you got an Omicron infection a month ago? We don't know how much less protective that the 18-month-old infection would be. But if you have got prior immunity from infection, then you can still make the case that an extra dose or two of, say, an mRNA vaccine, because those are the effective ones that we have available until we get Novavax available, that's probably going to boost your protection at a low risk of a serious adverse effect. I think the math shifts a little bit if you are an adolescent boy or a young man under the age of 25 or 30 where you might say, you know what, I'm very low risk of a severe infection no matter what I do. I've already had an infection that I survived, and therefore I probably have quite good vaccine-like immunity against the next exposure I might have. And I don't want to mess with a possible 1 in 3,000, 1 in 6,000 risk of something serious that could put me in the hospital, like a post-vaccine myocarditis.
So if someone says, if they are very young and very healthy at this point now, where Omicron is supplanting Delta, Omicron being more highly transmissible but apparently less deadly, we're now getting more data that suggests that, that the real decision for someone who's never been vaccinated, who's very young and very healthy, would be, is do I want the 1 in 200 chance that I would have if I got vaccinated of being hospitalized or dying? Or do I want, and if I get the vaccine, am I willing to run the somewhere between 1 in 3,000 and 1 in 6,000 chance that I might have myocarditis or some other threatening condition, and that would be the balance of the decision? Is that the issue?
So yes, it really comes down to the, for a person in their 40s or 50s, where the risk is in the one in a couple hundred, the math is going to favor vaccination in almost any possible situation. There is a small subgroup of adolescent boys and young men where their hospitalization risk might be as low as one in 3,000, 1 in 4,000 over the course of a year, in which they might be protected by getting fully vaccinated. And that myocarditis risk, if they get the second mRNA vaccine, really could be, the risk could be greater of the vaccine of being hospitalized with myocarditis rather than any hospitalization due to a COVID illness.
So in the bottom line, if I'm over 30 or if I have comorbidities or other vulnerabilities, you would clearly come down on the side of go get a vaccine right now, right?
Yeah, and it's really all girls and women are going to fall on the positive risk benefit side of vaccination, and likewise any man over the age of 30 as well. And so there's just a small subgroup of healthy people, healthy boys in that 12 to say 25 or 30 range, where you at least can make the case that some cost benefit calculus is warranted.
And if you were giving advice to one of those 12 to 30 year old males who are really, you could at least make the argument against a vaccine, would your bottom line as a physician be, ah, heck, go get the vaccine? Or would it be, ah, heck, forget the vaccine?
I am a primum non nocere sort of person, and I take the charge to do no harm seriously. But I feel like in this instance, there's so much societal pressure and benefit from getting vaccinated, if it's a close call for you, that I tend to encourage vaccination. But that said, what I do tell those people is something that's gaining more and more traction in the virology world, which is get the one shot. If you've already had a confirmed infection, you might want to stop there if you can, in terms of schools and sports and all that. And if you don't have a prior infection, then get the one shot and then still wait 8-12 weeks, because the chance of myocarditis and severe reactions goes down with time. We're not worried about you dying from a case of COVID if you were to get it before you get your second shot, but just wait a little bit longer, and it puts the odds in a completely different framework, and your chances of coming through fine go from overwhelmingly high to, you know, almost no chance of having a bad event. And then when it comes to boosters, that's where I feel firmly. There's just no evidence that there's societal benefit to boosting healthy young males, especially. And we know there's a risk.
But for someone older, someone in their 50s, 60s, someone who has comorbidities, you would recommend a booster, clearly?
Yeah. Somebody, an adult with comorbidities, a booster is almost always going to be favorable. And then my read on the data is somewhere around 60 or 65, it starts making pretty clear sense to get boosted, even if you're in good health. The main question there, and we're not going to know this for a little while longer, is do you get the benefits of the booster in terms of severe disease? Is it just those first few months where it's protecting you from infection, or is that a lasting benefit? And I feel like the science is absolutely still out on that one.
Any preference between Pfizer and Moderna?
Again, I think it comes down to where your risk tolerance lies. We've got a really good sense that Moderna is more likely to give you adverse reactions of all shapes and sizes. And that, at least in the original series at that higher dose, where you're talking about 100 micrograms instead of 30 micrograms for Pfizer, that you're probably going to get more durable protection. So for the people who tolerated their first round of shots fine, and they want to get the maximum possible booster, well, 50 micrograms of Moderna is probably going to, we don't really know, but probably, possibly going to give you better, longer protection than doing a 30 microgram booster with Pfizer. So, but on the other hand, if you are nervous about side effects, if you had a bad experience with your primary series, I tell people to go ahead and get Pfizer because we've got plenty of reassuring data about its effectiveness as a booster too.
So I wanted to do this, ladies and gentlemen, at this point with Buzz Hollander, MD, first to lay a foundation that I'm speaking to a responsible, careful physician who believes in the Hippocratic Oath, who says first, do no harm. As most of you know, my father was a physician and practiced medicine, family medicine, for 45 years and was deeply science-based and very clear, extremely clear about what he didn't know as he went on his way to using his best medical judgment to help his patients be well and stay well and become well. And so now I want to go into some more controversial territory with the understanding, I hope you have as I have, that Dr. Hollander takes this seriously. He is a vaccine advocate, as you've heard, with nuance, but a vaccine advocate overall. And so I think one of the problems that we had from the very beginning is that our public officials, President Trump, President Biden, were guilty of a lot of things, different things. President Trump had different problems than President Biden. But one of the things that President Biden said was that we're going to defeat COVID. Is it correct that we should stop thinking that we can ever stop the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the foundational virus that gives us COVID-19, and understand it's going to be with us forever?
Absolutely. I feel like I spent a fair bit of time on social media, trying to beat back these fantasy-based narratives that lead to a lot of social policy that I think has clear harms. At the very least, it stirs up a lot of hornet's nests in the public, but that have no chance of success. And what you just named is the poster child for COVID policies with no chance of success. And that is trying to eradicate COVID from the globe, eliminate it from the country. It is too transmissible. You're not going to get to herd immunity with a variant like Omicron that has almost complete escape of prior immunity, whether it's from a vaccine or from a prior infection. And you then throw into the mix animal reservoirs. There's just a study out on some martens, I think, but critters in the weasel family, I think in Europe or the UK, that were found to have COVID when they were. I don't think anybody wants to be doing nasal swabs in members of that species, but I assume they were found dead and then they checked them for COVID and they had it at a fairly high rate. I mean, something like 15% of them had COVID. We know that it's in the white-tailed deer. I have no idea how deer are getting COVID. I don't know what hunters are doing these days, but maybe it's gotten weird or they're having tea parties or something. But somehow this stuff is getting back and forth. And you cannot make COVID go away, even if there weren't the animal reservoirs. But that is the literal icing on the cake, that we have to learn to live with it. So that long game picture is critical. What are we comfortable doing for a long time, for the rest of our lives probably? And let's stop doing the stuff that we're not, because it's essentially pointless and creates harm along the way.
So one of the things I think is a problem with public understanding is that we're calling this a vaccine. And I think when we think of a vaccine, we think of something that if you take the vaccine, it's gone, a sterility vaccine, if you will. So, for example, if you get the polio vaccine, you don't get polio. And if you get the smallpox vaccine, you don't get smallpox. And if you did get polio or you did get smallpox after the vaccine, that would be a breakthrough infection. But some of that terminology, like vaccine and breakthrough, is being used with the COVID vaccines, where the vaccine that we have for the vaccines that we have for COVID, the messenger RNA vaccines, mRNA vaccines, they are not sterility vaccines. They don't prevent you from getting COVID. They reduce the symptoms so that you won't be hospitalized or die in all probability. And so to call it a vaccine, and then the press calls, when people then get COVID who've had a vaccine, they call it a breakthrough infection. It isn't really, is it?
Right. The use became more and more unfortunate as quote-unquote breakthrough infections became more and more common. I agree that this is not a these vaccines do not provide long-term sterilizing immunity. Something like that in the short term, when we're seeing these 95% numbers in the first month or three. But beyond that, we lose the antibodies that we have in our upper airways that can just quench this vaccine, I'm sorry, this virus on exposure. And so we're left with the very useful, more delayed responses that we might have in our lungs and our bloodstream that prevent a case from getting out of hand. Now, I would say that there are many vaccines, flu vaccine being the most famous among them, that don't provide sterilizing immunity. It does not mean this is not a vaccine. It is a vaccine. We prime the immune system to be better prepared to meet the pathogen. But it's not a vaccine that's going to give us herd immunity unless we get a very different variant along the way that somehow replaces Omicron despite being less transmissible and having less immune escape. Spoiler alert, that ain't going to happen. But with the variant we've got now, that's going to be hard to displace by anything that's not harder to deal with. You would literally need to vaccinate every, nearly 100% of the population and do it every 2 or 3 months to keep this virus at bay. And obviously that's not a realistic goal anywhere, probably not even in China or New Zealand.
What would you say to the schools, the school campuses that require weekly testing, or the people who have a stack of COVID tests that they've bought that are in their house, and they get tested, they test themselves on a weekly, some people more than weekly basis? What would you say to the people who are testing right now?
I would say, what is your goal? I suppose it's possible to have a goal that aligns with weekly or semi-regular testing of any kind of periodicity. But it's hard for me to think of one that really makes sense. At a nursing home, where even if people are vaccinated and boosted, and you just really want to keep the virus out because they're so vulnerable, okay, I think you could make a case for daily tests of staff. That's one of the only examples I can think of. And obviously, weekly testing is so inherently flawed because that's going to take care of 20% of your weekdays, but the other ones you're getting virtually no information, because especially with Omicron, you can go from zero to fully infectious in 6 or 8 hours. And it happens with almost every infection with Omicron, or so it appears. And so I just don't know the point of a program like that. And I think they're really hard to justify. I think it falls in that category of COVID theater that is becoming more and more popular.
Vaccine mandates. Now, I want to preface this so that we aren't misunderstood. I'm in favor of vaccines. You're in favor of vaccines. We think a vaccine is a very, very good idea. What do you think of a vaccine mandate?
I'm not a fan of it in this context for this virus with this vaccine, and for some of the reasons we've already discussed, namely, you can make a case for vaccine mandates, unless you're a libertarian, but you can make a case when herd immunity is a reachable goal. And with many of the childhood vaccines, polio, measles come right to mind. We have succeeded in making these viral infections almost non-existent by the sheer prevalence that the vaccine is out there in the public. So we see the sterilizing immunity, and we don't see the disease anymore. Since we can't get there with COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2, then the only way to really justify a vaccine mandate is saying, we're doing this for your own good. If we don't force as many people as possible who are vulnerable to get this vaccine, we're going to see hospital strain. We've seen it multiple times in multiple places already. So we're doing this just to keep society functioning. And you can make that case. It's really hard to make that case and include it to young, healthy people. In other words, vaccine mandates in colleges are not keeping the hospitals empty. It's just, you need to vaccinate and or boost so many thousands or tens of thousands of college students to prevent a single hospitalization that it's pointless. But if you wanted to say you're going to force vaccination upon everybody over 50 or 60, you could at least make a societal case. But whew, is it worth the pushback? And do you have a chance of success in this country? I think the answer to both those questions is no.
I believe that the American spirit and the independence of Americans fights against mandates of any kind to begin with. There was huge controversy decades ago about motorcycle helmet requirements, and people would make the argument that it's a burden to society to pay for people who are brain damaged on motorcycle accidents, so we should require them to wear helmets because it's unfair to have to pay all of their medical expenses. But then, of course, the next logical argument would be, well, why not prohibit motorcycles altogether? And then perhaps you should prohibit bacon, because if you eat too much of that, and so forth. And Mayor Bloomberg...
Hey, Steve, you're crossing a line right now. That is crossing a line.
We don't want to mess with bacon. We're going to leave bacon alone. And Mayor Bloomberg, when he was mayor in New York, came up with the idea of banning large sodas. And it's still not clear to me if he was trying to make a point or prove a point or if he really was in favor of them. But assuming he was, I wouldn't have agreed with him. I think that where I draw the line is I don't want the government to protect me from me. I want the government to protect me from you, and I want the government to protect you from me. So I'm in favor of all of those mandates, laws, and restrictions and prohibitions, but I'm not in favor of the government protecting me from me. And the argument you've just made, Dr. Hollander, is that really the only reason that you could have to support a vaccine mandate is to protect the unvaccinated themselves. But we've had so much confusion over this that I know many people who are vaccinated who say, I can't be in the presence of an unvaccinated person because they are a risk to me. Looks to me like it's the other way around.
It is a real problem with that argument, and certainly trying to use OSHA as the framework to try to have the recently rejected large business mandate that it's for workplace safety. That clearly doesn't work because the protection against infection from a vaccine that's more than a few months old is so low. So no, we can't and shouldn't try to protect vaccinated people from unvaccinated people by making unvaccinated people get their vaccine. It just doesn't hold together logically. And if all we're trying to do is keep the hospitals functioning, my libertarian friends insist we just need to expand our hospital capacity rather than make people put something in their bodies that they don't want. And maybe they're right.
That brings us to an article that you wrote that appeared in Real Clear Science on January 4, 2022, some 18 days ago. And in that article, the article is entitled Enough Already of the COVID State. And in that article, you say the following, and I quote, "The United States has become a nation divided. To the red states, the blues are oppressive. To the blue states, the reds are reckless. Everyone is angry at the CDC for either being too easy on COVID-19 transmission or too hard on society. Accelerating the geographic clumping of our populace by political belief is a destructive force socially, politically, and economically." Buzz Hollander, what was the CDC's biggest mistake in the pandemic?
You could point to a lot of things that the CDC and the public health community would probably ask for a do-over on if they could get one. But if I had to pick one thing, it would be the heavy-handed messaging. And there's been a lot of examples of this, from masking, whether SARS-CoV-2 is airborne, how we should handle boosters. There have been so many examples, but I think they dug themselves deeper holes than they needed to with their very confident expressions of scientific reality that are impossible to be confident about. They're in a tough spot. Everybody has been in a tough spot throughout this pandemic because it's complicated. The data changes so fast, and we're all in a brave new world of trying to figure out how to respond to a pandemic like this. But they sure added to the degree of difficulty by making statements that were generally without nuance and didn't allow for the possibility of being wrong, or that they might need to scrap everything and start all over again in a week or two when there's new data. And it has created a real problem of trust with many people and how they view the institutions that are supposed to be giving them good advice about how to proceed in the face of a pandemic.
When we watch the news, we see constant reports as to the number of new COVID cases. And it never struck me as what mattered. What mattered is how many hospitalizations are there and how many deaths are there. And then even when I hear about hospitalizations, I hear statistics that just don't help me. They say, and this is, I'm not talking about wild media, I'm talking about CBS, NBC, ABC, hospitals are nearing capacity. I saw one that said ICU beds, intensive care unit beds, are 83% full. That was on Meet the Press this past Sunday. Well, hospital beds in ICUs, what is it normally? Is it 82%? I mean, they aren't empty. So when I'm listening to the news, do I care about how many cases there are? Do I care that an ICU is 83% full? Or do I only care about, number one, hospitalizations and deaths? And number two, where a hospital is telling me not what its percentage of capacity is, but that they are dangerously full. Do I care about anything but besides those two things?
I think you're right on, Steve. I think cases are useful to know when things are picking up steam, because that helps people both make better decisions. Maybe it's not the time to go watch the game in the bar this Sunday. And also to be prepared, if you're a hospital administrator, to know it's time to make sure that your staffing is ready to roll, because things are probably going to get hairier in a week or two. And it's also helpful to know when we've hit a crest, because again, you can start to prepare differently and make different decisions. That's what I think cases are useful for. Daily case counts and pumping them up in the news cycle, I think, has been not a helpful trend throughout this pandemic. And then I agree with hospitalization. There, so much of the use of statistics through this pandemic has been, I've got a point to make and I'm going to find the statistic to make it the way I want it to. And rather than, I'm going to look at the statistics and then figure out what point I should make. And so, yes, ICU beds were not made to stand empty, because it's expensive to have ICUs and it's very expensive to staff them, because ICU nurses are more highly trained than floor nurses and they're more expensive to hire. So the American hospital system is built to run near capacity. That's how it is. If you don't like it, you know, elect Bernie Sanders and maybe it'll be different, but that's what we're looking at for the near future. And the more relevant statistic, I agree totally, is how is our hospital comparison compared to what it normally is? How is our hospital capacity compared to how it normally is at this time of year in years past? How much more can we absorb relative to what we're expecting in terms of the epidemic curve? That's a useful way to present hospitalizations to help people know how dire the situation is, because there are definitely times and places where the situation has been dire, where as a doctor, it's hard for me to get my patient a hospital bed if they have cancer or a stroke. And that's not good for anybody when that's happening.
You said this pandemic has been an utter disaster. The next one might be worse. Bolstering our national capacity to fight off viruses would be a wise investment. That's a quote. So what are the things we need to do to prepare for the next national, to bolster our national capacity to fight off viruses for the next pandemic?
It's hard not to look at two main factors there. And one of them is building trust that we have a functional CDC and all the related public health institutions so that people will be inclined to listen to their advice. Now, the functional part of things is that they're doing appropriate research and are really adding to our understanding of what we're confronting, because it's going to be different, of course, in ways that we don't know. And then the other that I would say is to take a look at how vulnerable we are as a people and to viral or bacterial infections, potentially, whatever our next pandemic might be. And the things that you can do for that are not easy. They're not easy adjustments, whether you're looking at it from a societal level and hospital capacity or on a personal level. And what can we do about having lower rates of overweight, obesity, diabetes in our populace so that we're less vulnerable to infection in general, and how we can improve access to healthcare, access to vaccination, open-minded attitudes towards vaccination so that we're just more ready to avoid such disaster the next time we have to confront something like this.
People who have listened to my January 30, 2021 show, I did 6 days after I was released from the hospital after a 15-day stay for COVID, will remember that I said that in the preceding year and a half before I contracted COVID, I had lost slowly and smoothly about 55 pounds. And I've been told by four of my doctors, that had I not lost those 55 pounds, I would not have survived COVID. So isn't it true, Dr. Hollander, that one of the main indicators as to whether you die from COVID or not is whether you are obese? There are others to be sure, but isn't that one of the leading questions?
Absolutely. Metabolic health and the detrimental effects on that with obesity really seems to be a trigger for whether or not you have a dangerous inflammatory reaction to an infection like SARS-CoV-2.
And so then we move to the politics question. And why did science get mixed up with politics? And what's the end result of that in this COVID pandemic?
Well, the end result is definitely a terrible mess. Why it happened, I think you have to look back at the political climate when this was all coming to the fore at the beginning of 2020, with so much division and intensity around Donald Trump being president. And I think for the first few weeks when we were seeing COVID in this country, there was a relative sense of unity and this is serious and we're going to need to figure this out as a country. And then it quickly began to polarize. So if you were not a fan of Trump and he espoused something, whether it was ending lockdowns earlier than some of the experts were recommending or Project Warp Speed for vaccination, then you're going to find fault with it. And if you were a fan, then you're going to align yourself. And once that process started, you never saw anybody take their foot off the gas. And you could make the case that it's worse today than it has been at any point in the pandemic in terms of people are aligning themselves intellectually with what they want to believe because it fits their political or societal or philosophical belief system rather than what the science is plainly telling them right in front of their nose. And it leads to a very non-scientific approach to something that badly needs good science.
The problem, of course, then, is that statistics, as reported again by the media, are very misleading. I've two statistics that we need to bear in mind. Number one is that 82.67% of all statistics are made up on the spot. That's one problem. And the second problem is that 6 out of 7 dwarfs say they are not happy. Now, this is true, but it's useless. And this is what we get when we have these statistics that come out and are taken at face value. We have to be very careful when we listen to the news. Mainstream news, especially then the social media news, and things that we see on social media, but a degree of skepticism, a pound of salt, not a grain of salt, needs to be taken with all the things that we hear, it seems.
It's a huge problem, and one that I don't see what the solution is, and I don't see how or why it goes away. And it's been drawn in stark contrast with COVID-19, where you have people in different factions, and whether it is anti-vaxxers who are willfully distorting the statistics we do have to make a case that these vaccines are deadly and dangerous, that just explodes my head sometimes when I read what seemingly intelligent people will write and put out on social media. That is really hard for someone that has no background in medicine or biostatistics. They look at this and it's so compelling. And I can't blame people who are vaccine hesitant that read these things, who then think that I am feeding them a bunch of lies when I tell them that it's a good idea for them to get vaccinated. But you see it on the other side too. And it also drives me nuts is when the CDC will quote a terrible study and try to claim that an adolescent boy is more likely to get myocarditis from COVID-19 than from the vaccine. I mean, it's absolute poppycock. It's not even close. The risk is probably 50 times higher from the vaccine for some segments of the population. And it pains me to see reputable, smart people making these statements that are transparently false. But if you read them without a background, it's impossible to know or even think that they might not be telling the truth.
We're getting near the end of our hour, but I have so much more I want to do. Do you have another 10 or 15 minutes for me?
I do, and hopefully my computer does too.
Okay, good. We'll hope it holds together. One of the conversations I had with an extremely intelligent client of mine, I'm a practicing real estate and business attorney for the past 44 years, and one of my clients is an investment broker. He is brilliant. He guides investments for people in the stock market and does it himself individually, does the research. He's so smart and he's been right about every trend, and I've known him for 3 decades. And he's not vaccinated. And I had a whole conversation with him about it, and I was arguing for him to be vaccinated. And he was explaining to me that although he's 66 years old and he's in great health, and although he's heard all about the vaccines, he just doesn't feel like he needs it, and he feels like he'd be okay. And he said, but, and again, he's a rational player. He's going to talk to his doctor. This conversation I had with him 3 months ago. I'm going to have conversation with my doctor, and I'm going to ask all my questions. And I said, here's the recommendation I have for you. If you meet with your own physician, and you ask the doctor who knows your medical condition, your individual response to medications, your individual medical history, your family medical history, and so forth, if that doctor tells you to get vaccinated at the end of the conversation and you still don't, then get another doctor. Because that doctor in a critical moment may need to make medical decisions for you. And if you don't trust him to give you advice on whether to get a vaccine or not, how about when he decides to take you into surgery and open up your chest or send you to do something on an emergency basis when you're not in a position to decide? Get a doctor who you will rely on. And what that conversation did for me is it established for me the following policy. Read anything you want on the internet, watch anything you want on television, listen to whatever the CDC says. But when it comes to medical decisions, ask your doctor. Ask your personal physician who knows your individual responses. One of the things my dad, a physician, told me is we really don't know the perfect dosage of any medication for any individual patient because everybody metabolizes differently. So what might be for two people who are as close as we can get as milligram per kilogram based on your weight, we can give you a particular dosage. But there are some people who can, and you can see this if someone drinks alcohol, there are some people of the same weight who have one drink and they feel absolutely nothing, and someone else has one drink and is ready to fall on the floor. So my view was, ask your doctor. Buzz, what do you think?
Clearly, that is what we want people to do when they're absorbing information from a lot of different sources that might not all be reputable or might not be in integrity with the advice that they're giving. I think the only catch with that, Steve, is that there's been a lot written about this, but there is that cachet of having a contrarian viewpoint around traditional COVID advice that's coming out of the institutions. And I get this. I'm lucky enough to have gone to Princeton, so I've got a very smart cohort of friends who, as you describe with your real estate connection, they can figure stuff out. They can figure out markets and give investment advice and all of that. And I get a barrage of emails and texts and, you know, what about this? What about that? This guy says ivermectin should clearly be a first choice instead of vaccination and all of this. And I look at it, I break it down. The way this information gets presented is you are a stooge if you think that vaccines are better than ivermectin. You are a loser if you don't realize that these vaccines are causing more harm than good. And it's very persuasively written. And not every doctor, I have the luxury of having a small direct primary care practice. So I can take an hour every morning over my coffee and read what these people are saying. You can't even guess it oftentimes. And your average doctor with 2,000 people in their practice just doesn't have the luxury of time to do that. And so when smart people take these complaints and concerns that they read about from Steve Kirsch or Robert Malone, often what they hear the doctor say back sounds so much like an echo of what the CDC is saying, they don't trust it. They would trust the doctor to make the call on whether or not they need to go to the cardiac cath lab, but they can't trust the doctor about the vaccines because they think the wool has been pulled over their eyes.
That's a fantastic response. I had not even thought of it from that direction, but you're 100% right. That creates an untenable position for a patient who is faced with a doctor who is confused. That's frightening. Let me go in a different direction for the final piece of all of this. I'm going to tell you three stories, but they're going to sound very familiar to you, Buzz, because they are out of an article that you wrote for, again, Real Clear Science. And the title of the article is "The Problems with Censoring Doctors Over Their COVID-19 Stances." This is an article that was published on October 7, 2021. And it dovetails with what you're talking about. So here's the first story. Imagine that, and I'm, again, ladies and gentlemen, I'm reading, this is quoting from an article by Buzz Hollander, MD, and then we're going to ask him to respond to that. Imagine this. You're a physician in charge of opening an intensive care unit in New York City for COVID-19 patients in March 2020 as the disease is tearing through the city. You notice that the standard protocols your hospital follows for intubated patients seems to be failing, perhaps injuring your patients with COVID-19. Rumblings from Chinese intensivists and publications from Italian physician Luciano Gattatoni imply that intubation and ventilator management should be reconsidered in this new disease. Your hospital is reluctant to change their well-established protocols for ventilators. Most of your intubated patients are dying. What do you do?
I think in that case, the answer for most people is going to be forget the protocol, do what you think is right, that's driven by the best evidence you've got in that moment.
This was one of the things that was so, and I became very aware of this when I was in the hospital in January of 2021, and they went through an entire, and I described this in detail on that January 30, 2021 episode of this show, as to how they had me prone, that is, lay on my stomach, and how it saved my life, where if instead of being in a hospital in January of 2021, if I had been in a hospital in March of 2020, instead of telling me to lay on my stomach, they'd have put me on a ventilator and I would have died, because the ventilator could not deal with, you could pump air into someone's lungs, but that wasn't the problem. The problem was that the lungs couldn't absorb the oxygen and they couldn't derive it to send it into the bloodstream. And the ventilator not only didn't help with that, it ended up suffocating people, in effect, as they drowned in what was in their lungs that had the consistency of cake batter. And so how do you turn that around in that moment? And I guess you've answered that question. Any further thought on that, or I'll tell you the second story?
Yeah, go ahead. Second story.
An Israeli soldier comes into your emergency room in early February 2021, complaining of chest pain and a rapid heart rate, and is diagnosed with myocarditis. He was vaccinated against COVID-19 with the Pfizer mRNA vaccine 4 days prior. You report it to local media as a possible vaccine adverse reaction, and the news is widely circulated as one of the first reports of this now well-recognized potential complication of the mRNA vaccines, most notably in young men.
And that one is a little bit trickier. I would say that it's appropriate to bring that to a wide audience immediately. I'm sure there are some people in the public health community especially who would say, no, this might be a one in a million reaction. You maybe write a letter to a medical journal, you let some time pass, you give it to the professionals first before you send it out to the public. But I would argue that in case it turns out it's a one in 500 sort of reaction, you want to get the news out and let your colleagues sort this out as rapidly as possible. That is both the right thing to do to protect the public, and ultimately, personally, my faith in the vaccine safety process has gone up enormously through this whole COVID pandemic, because I've watched in real time how faithfully people have, scientists and physicians have reported concerns. We saw this with the thrombosis issues, with the adenovirus vector vaccines. We've seen it with myocarditis, with the mRNA vaccines. The data has come out incredibly quickly, and it's given physicians a chance to give good risk-benefit counseling to their patients. I think that whatever cost that's had, for instance, that myocarditis story, I'm sure there was a cost in men choosing not to get vaccinated, and some of them died because of that choice. But in the long term, the erosion of trust that's possible if you squelch all the bad news for as long as possible, and then all of a sudden studies come out that it's a 1 in 3,000 sort of risk, I think that loss of trust maybe leads to more death in the long term than simply some bad news coming out early.
Let me do a third scenario. You are a family and emergency room physician in rural British Columbia whose clinic begins to distribute some 900 doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine in March 2021. You claim to observe two cases of anaphylaxis, a vaccine-associated death, and three more severe adverse reactions to the vaccine, and write an email to your colleagues in the area suggesting a pause in the vaccination program. When this leads only to a professional rebuke and a gag order, you write a public letter to the British Columbia Provincial Health Officer and soon find yourself removed from your position in the emergency room. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's the grayest of gray zones there, I think. I think the concern almost without doubt was sincere. I think with 2020 hindsight, you can see that this was a bubble of bad events, and whether it was literally as simple as a bad batch, a poorly transported batch of vaccine is possible. And also, you know, when it rains, it pours in medicine. It just might have been a statistical outlier, and you had a bunch of very rare events happening to concentrate in one place. So I can't fault, in this case, a particular ER physician in Canada, I cannot fault him for being alarmed, because when it's happening to you in patients you've known for possibly decades, it is easy to understand how you'd have this desire to protect people, not just your patients, but patients you haven't met yet. I think, though, that in this case, a little humility around the fact that you are not the only one who's been dispensing vaccines for the past few weeks, that this is going on millions wide around the world, and having some conversations, as many as possible, with your colleagues and saying, are you seeing this? How many of your patients have gotten vaccinated? How are they doing? And I think what you would have gotten over and over again is, they're fine. No adverse reactions. No, I heard a one person, you know, 500 miles away who had anaphylaxis. And I think that's the point where you put the brakes on and say, okay, what I'm seeing is a statistical anomaly, and I'm not going to try to amp up alarm and create a lot of problems and feed vaccine hesitancy by going public with this. I'm going to just watch and see what could have happened and investigate a little more cautiously instead of blowing a horn about this.
So this is particularly important in today's media society, where if it bleeds, it leads, and members of the media really are looking for action. They're looking for stories. They're not looking for, they'll put in the feel-good story here at the end of the news for 2 minutes. But what they really want is to keep people two things, one angry and the other one frightened. And if they can keep people both angry and frightened, then they find out they get more listeners, more clicks, more readers, more viewers, and they do better in their careers if they can keep people angry and frightened. So when you look at this, the issue is that when you find something that you need to report and you're a physician and you see it, I think you're right, Buzz, they have to be very careful before they go and do this, because if the press grabs it and is alarmist about it, which is what they'll do if they think they can alarm people, because again, they want to alarm people, then you end up with a situation where something is blown way out of proportion. This is what happened, I think, in South Africa, was it, where they discovered Omicron for the first time and they announced it. They handled it responsibly. They immediately said, look, it doesn't look as deadly, but it looks more highly transmissible. And they were punished. Various countries cut off travel from their area, and they were criticized, and they were upset, and they really got it right from the start. But the press made a hash of it again, and this is a problem. This is why when you listen to any political commentator on any side of the debate, they will all tell you that we are a sharply divided country, and we're not. There are 10% of nuts on the far left and 10% of nuts on the far right, and that 10% and 10%, they're sharply divided. But the 80% of us in the middle, who are center left or center right, but are moderate and rational, we're not sharply divided. We're all pretty much in agreement, but we don't have a voice because we can't make headlines. And so the nuts are sharply divided. The press says we're sharply divided. And that's the environment in which these three stories that I told you from your October 7, 2021 article, these stories reflect the risk there is to any physician who reports facts from their own medical practice without being cautious. And I think being cautious is a good idea, but the risk is still there, even with caution, that the press will pick it up, whip it into a huge frenzy, and that the physician ends up suffering as a result of it, and society doesn't benefit. You get the last word. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that there's little doubt that if it bleeds, it leads. If it bleeds, it leads. And that does in turn lead to a lot of sensationalism in reporting. I tend to agree that the divide within the country is overstated because, again, it's good press. And extreme positions are simpler to represent and describe. Nuance takes time and it can lose people. And I think the other thing is it takes speed to lead. And that has been a big problem in that in this social media climate where everybody can be a star reporter, it is often tempting to jump to the first possible conclusion if it's catchy, if it sounds important, and taking the time, as I once saw somebody write in a Twitter reply, was you'd think they'd at least have sent it to their mom to check their math. And that sort of thing is not happening enough. We see it all. It's been so frustrating from a physician's perspective. I need good research to guide my recommendations. And the vast majority of research that's been done during the pandemic, you look at it on first read, you say, wow, that is a deeply flawed study design. Why didn't they run that by somebody else who could have pointed out, you know, you can't let the control group do that. It's going to undermine the data. And we keep seeing this happen over and over again. And that to me has been the most frustrating part of this whole experience, as miserable it's been, has been people unwilling to reach across the aisle and say, hey, is there a little common ground we can talk about here? And scientists unable or unwilling to speak to each other and say, how can we clean up our data? How can we present it better? How can we run better studies? You know, everybody is in their own insular world, it seems like, and it's really hamstrung our ability to have a cogent response to a difficult situation.
Dr. Buzz Hollander, I want to say thank you so much for being with me here today on TalkRadio1.com. This conversation has exceeded my very high expectations, and I hope it's been a benefit to everyone who has listened. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Hey, I really appreciate having me on, Steve.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Dr. Buzz Hollander, a medical doctor. Hopefully this has shed some light. I would love to hear any comments you have. Send me an email. I'd love to know what you think and get your point of view on this. My next show will be 1 week from today. That's next Saturday. And my guest is going to be James Wallman. James Wallman has been with us before. He has a book called Time and How to Spend It, The 7 Rules for Richer, Happier Days. Now, I thought at first this was going to be a book on time management and organization, and it's not. It's a way to look at life, to be able to manage your time, to be able to spend your time, because we each get the time we get. We can't borrow more, we can't get more, we can't buy more. We can't even save it. All we can do is spend it. And the idea of taking a look at how to look at your life in a different way, I think, is going to be worthwhile. That's next Saturday, 1 week from today, Saturday, January 29, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Please use our Amazon, eBay, and PayPal links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com to keep the podcasts available to you at no cost. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.